talking about church finances. And as we began, we made the point that the church and Christianity in general has always been foundationally sacrificial. It was based on Jesus' sacrifice, and now we continue that sacrifice. Not that we're going to go to the cross, but there is a certain sense in which Christianity is a sacrificial relationship. And we talked about, let's talk a little bit about sacrificial giving. It's a means of our spiritual development. And when you try to shortcut that and you look for ways to raise funds that are not built on a sacrificial relationship, then it really cheapens the funds. That's a bad pun, I guess. It cheapens it. It makes it so that it no longer has the purpose that it has in the beginning. And so the church becomes just a fundraising effort. I don't know if you've ever watched these guys that have television programs, but it always struck me that it just seemed like about half of their time on the air was devoted to raising funds to keep that show on the air. And I don't think that's the way it ought to be. I think in many ways that's essentially robbery. We could talk a lot about what they do, but it just strikes me as being just robbery. But we talked about the passages that outline in the book of Acts what the early Christians' response was to the needs that existed in the churches where they were worshiping. When we talked about this from the book of Acts early on, we of course were talking about churches that responded to needs that existed within the congregation. But as the church began to grow, and especially as it began to influence the Gentile world, and that, remember, that wasn't for about 10 years. That didn't happen until the 10th chapter of Acts when Cornelius is converted. As the church begins to grow outside of Jerusalem, largely because of persecution, the churches responded to needs that existed in other places. So after the church begins to grow, Acts the 11th chapter talks about a famine that happened in Judea. Now this Judea, that's the general area, but it of course would have included Jerusalem. So when this famine happened in Jerusalem, the church from its own sources could not meet the needs that existed there in Jerusalem, even though we've already seen that they were willing to sacrificially meet those needs. If they had lands or houses, they sold them, they gave the money so that they could make distribution to people that had need. That we've already seen that. But eventually, you will exhaust the resources that are available to you. So you see that happening today in war-torn areas. The church in throughout the whole Crimean Peninsula, but particularly in Ukraine, has exhausted their resources taking care of the needs that existed within those churches. And so they're going to have help. When the earthquake hit Alaska in 1964, Ann could talk about this more than I can, but I don't think you weren't even in Alaska when the earthquake happened, were you? I think Ann got there shortly after the earthquake in 1964. And it just decimated Anchorage. So churches across the country recognized that the church in Anchorage no longer had the resources to meet the needs that might exist there. And so churches from across the country sent so much stuff to Alaska. Kind of what they were afraid of was that stores of things that people needed, stocks of things that people needed, had been wiped out. So you wouldn't have a blanket. So they sent blankets. They sent tents. It was, from talking to some of the old timers that were there in 1964, it was more than the church could handle. They eventually had to get in touch with people and say, stop. We have more than we can use. So this is not something that's unusual. It could happen because of a famine. It could happen because of war. It could happen because of some sort of natural disaster. But a church could exhaust its resources. So let's look at these passages and we'll see how Christians responded to other churches that had exhausted their resources. Now, when we look at this, remember, we're talking about a collective activity. Individuals might also have responded to this, but we're talking about a collective activity. One church was assembling material, whether it was funds or it was goods, and they were sending it to the aid of another church that had exhausted its funds. So can I get somebody to read Acts 11? And this sort of sets the stage for what happened. Acts 11, verses 28 through 30.
And one of them named Agabus stood up and began to indicate by the Spirit that there would certainly be a great famine all over the world. And this took place in the reign of Claudius. And in the proportion that any of the disciples had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. And this they did, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders.
Okay. So not only does the biblical record talk about this, but the secular history also talks about this, and we can identify this famine that happened in that area during the reign of Claudius. It was particularly bad in Judea. It wasn't as bad in some other areas as it was in Judea, but it was terrible. So the Christians are going to help the church in Judea. And they took up a collection. They sent it to Judea by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Back then, you didn't have post offices and that kind of thing. Transferring money was incredibly difficult all the way up until the time of the Crusades, when now I can't remember the name of the Catholic group, the Knights Templar, basically set up a banking system. And you could, if you were in Germany, you could deposit money with the Knights Templar, and this big organization would take care of making that money available to people that were in Jerusalem fighting in the Crusades. So, but that kind of banking system didn't exist prior to the Crusades. You couldn't put money in an envelope and send it anywhere. You really had to find someone to physically take possession of the funds and move the funds to a particular location. Now, today, we have wonderful post office, we have wonderful banking system, and it works like a champ until you start trying to send money to a foreign country. And if you send money to the Philippines, you almost need to have some contact in the Philippines. And I'm not picking on the Philippines, but it's a place where we have frequently helped. And in the Philippines, the government tends to be corrupt, and they take some of the funds, particularly if those funds are sent to a church. So we tend to work around that by sending it to an individual, much like they were sending it by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Barnabas and Saul didn't have any control of those funds. In fact, they might not even have known how much they had with them in terms of funds. They just transported it. So it's like you put it in a bag and you gave it to Paul, and you had to trust him that he was going to take it to Jerusalem and disperse it. And many times they dispersed it through the eldership in a particular local place, because the elders would know who had need. So this is what was going on. Let's look at Acts 24 at verse 17. Can I get someone to read that one?
Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings.
Okay. So this is kind of Paul talking about the other end of this whole journey. The churches took up funds, they gave it to Paul, and Paul says, eventually I got to Jerusalem. I went to Jerusalem to bring alms to my nation. And that would have been the apostles' offering to his Jewish ancestry, and also to bring offerings that had been taken up by other churches. So in the 11th chapter, you have one side of this, churches deciding they were going to help. Acts 24, you have the other side of this. You have Paul saying, I got there with the funds. Let's look at Romans 15.
For Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem.
Okay. And they had decided to do that by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 8.
Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in wealth of their liberality.
And I should have asked you to read all the way down through verse 6. Sorry.
For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participating in the support of the saints, and this not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. So we urged Titus that as he had previously made a beginning, so he would also complete in you this gracious work as well.
Thank you, Lenny. So what you have is the reiteration of that principle that we started with. Remember, Christianity is a sacrificial relationship. And these folks that have decided they're going to help the saints in Judea, in fact, you would have looked at them and say, how are you helping? You're in as bad a shape as they are. But Paul, in the third verse, he says, beyond their power, they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift. I get the impression, and this is just an impression. Paul doesn't say this. But Paul was going to take this gift to Jerusalem. And they wanted to contribute to that gift. And I almost feel like Paul was saying, no, you know, you guys barely have enough to eat anyway. There's no way that you ought to be doing this. It's almost as if Paul is saying, you're putting yourselves at risk because you want to participate in this so badly. That's that sacrificial kind of relationship. And Paul doesn't censure them for what their desire was, but does anybody else see that in this reading? But Paul is really saying it's so much more than we could have thought about. But it's back to this sacrificial relationship. Okay, let's look at 2 Corinthians 9. And I think this also bears on this question. And I should have indicated to read down through verse 5 this time. Can I get somebody to read that one?
For as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous, whichever, for me to write to you, for I know the forwardness of your mind, for which I boast of you to them of Macedonia, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal hath provoked very many. Yet have I sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain, in this behalf, that, as I said, you may be ready. Lest haply, if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, we that we say not ye should be ashamed in this same confident boasting. Therefore, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they would go before unto you and make up beforehand your bounty, whereof you had noticed before, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty, and not as covetousness.
Okay. So what the apostle, in my mind, is saying is we're coming through, and it's not like Paul is going to make the next, you know, he's going to make 12 trips to Judea in the next 6 months delivering these funds. Travel was a big deal. So Paul said, take this up, have it ready when we get there. So that, you know, we've been boasting about you wanting to do this. When we get there, we want to find the contribution that you have put together to send to Judea. So we sent the brothers to come there and to help you put it together, so that when we get there, it's ready to go. until Paul picked it up, who did the funds belong to?
The individuals, because they were giving it directly, right?
Well, that's an interesting question. You had the individuals there that were going to put the funds into a common pool, and that common fund was what was going to be delivered. And you know, I think you made a good point, Carol. If you go back to Acts and the question with Ananias and Sapphira, when they sold their property and they were going to give part of it to the church, who did the funds belong to? It still belonged to Ananias and Sapphira until they put it into the common pool. And once you did that, then it passed from you into the common pool. The funds, the way I read this, never belonged to Paul and Barnabas and the people that were appointed to take the funds to Jerusalem. They were just messengers. This was work that they had begun. And of course, he says, you've begun this work a year ago. So you've been putting this together. Paul says, I know the forwardness of your mind, and that's why it was superfluous, or superfluous just means it's unnecessary for me to write to you. Because I know you're already wanting to do this. So churches, whether it was individuals, I don't think it was individuals who put together the funds and said, Paul, take my funds to Jerusalem. I get the impression from reading all of these passages and from looking at 1 Corinthians 16, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, from reading all of these passages, that individuals pooled their resources in the church so that that pool of money could be taken to Jerusalem. So once you put your money in the pool, you don't have control over it. I remember when I was preaching in one place, we had a lady who insisted that if I'm going to give money to the church, I'm going to figure out where it's going to go. And it's like, I'm going to put my money in the pool, but I still want to decide how that money is spent. That's not the way it works. Once you put the money in the pool, it's not yours anymore. Now, when it's yours, you can decide what you want to do with it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but if everybody said, well, this is how much I'm going to give and this is how much I'm going to give, and they don't contribute it like we do every Sunday sort of thing, but they still set it aside and it's still there, when the day comes for everybody to bring the money that is supposed to be there, it could all come in all at one time at the end. And then it's under the control of whoever did. Or it could come into the elders just a few days before and then go that way. So,
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I would even argue that though it's in your control, you have already decided to contribute it to the work, that to the famine work in Jerusalem. So it might be in your control, but I don't think you would, I think you would be misappropriating the funds if you decided, oh, no, I'm going to use it for something else. Once you've set it aside, that's what it's for. And we'll kind of talk about that a little bit more. But you do raise, I think, a really interesting idea, Carol. You know, we talk about let's just read 1 Corinthians 16, 1 through 4. And then we'll talk about 1 Corinthians 16 for just a minute. So can I get somebody to read 1 Corinthians 16, 1 through 4?
Now concerning collection for the saints, as I have directed the churches of Galatia to do so, so do you also. On the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, so that no collections be made when I come. When I arrive, whomever you may approve, I will send them with letters to carry your gifts to Jerusalem. And if it is fitting for me to go also, they will go with me.
Okay. So I get the impression that what they did was they set it aside and saved it. And much like the Apostle Paul had sent the brethren to help the churches make up the funds, he might have done that here. Now, whether they physically put it in the pool before Paul got there or was ready to get there, doesn't matter. They set it aside and they saved it. Does that make sense? So now, let's take this one step further. As I read this, the need came first, and then the contribution from individuals to meet the need came second. And I have a feeling, just from watching the way that churches work, is that we think the contribution comes first, and then out of the contribution, we pick and choose needs that we can meet. And I think that we're getting that backwards. The need comes first. So we identify what the need is. And once we've identified what the need is, then we meet the need. Now, in terms of budgeting, just in terms of a very practical approach to this, we have needs that we have to meet. This church does. One of the needs that we have is to pay our electric bill. It's a recurring bill. It comes in. We pay that so that we can have the lights on in the building, and most of the time so that we can have air conditioning in the building and we can have heat in the building. So we have to pay that bill. This is not something that is like the famine in Jerusalem. That was a one-time thing, or perhaps it would go on for a couple of years. In our case, paying the electrical bill, that's just a recurring thing. So there's always a need that we could set before ourselves and determine that we were going to meet that need. Some needs you can reasonably anticipate. Okay. A need that you can reasonably anticipate would be to look at the building and say, well, we have a roof on the building, and the roof has an expected lifetime of 20 years or 50 years. So we know that every 20 years or every 50 years or whatever, we're going to have to put a new roof on the building. And I was talking with Dean this morning, and we were talking about the air conditioning, and the air conditioning, of course, has gone out. We're going to have to replace the air conditioning. And you think, well, that's something we could reasonably anticipate, right? The air conditioning has a life, an expected life of, I think Dean said that the people he was talking to said the expected life is about 6 to 8 years on commercial air conditioning like that. And that air conditioner has been there for 30 years. So if we had said, we have this need out here, we're going to have to meet it. We know we're going to have to meet it. So let's just start setting aside funds to meet that need when it gets here. We're not trying to build up a surplus. We're anticipating a need. And that's different than building a surplus just to have a big bank account. We're not trying to build a surplus when we set this aside. It's earmarked for something. And that's what the elders do when they put together our budget. I've listened to them talk about the budget, and they set down what those needs are and what the needs are that we can reasonably anticipate. Like we're going to have to pay for replacing the air conditioning. And we have to pay for repaving the parking lot. If you don't take care of those things, the parking lot would fall apart. And we're already seeing some signs that it's getting to be time that if you're going to take care of your parking lot, you have to do this. It's no different than what happens in our homes. Okay. So you have a continuous need. You have needs that are reasonably anticipated. So you're going to build, it looks like you're building a surplus, but you're not really building a surplus. It's earmarked. We're setting aside and we're saving. I don't know what we determined we're going to save $1,000 a year because we know that in 12 to 15 years, we're going to have to replace the air conditioning unit, and that's going to cost us about $15,000. So year 14, it looks like we've got $15,000 in the bank. And somebody says, well, you're just building a surplus. No, we're not building a surplus. That money is already earmarked. We've already decided what we're going to spend that on. And we're setting it aside and saving it. Sometimes what happens is we've set money aside to replace the air conditioner, and then there's a terrible famine or terrible economic downturn. Half the church winds up losing their jobs. So we have to say, well, we've set this money aside to replace the air conditioner, but we have this pressing need. We're going to have to divert those funds to take care of this pressing need. And that's reasonable. Now, I don't think that was the case in Corinth. I don't think they had a surplus built up. My impression from the church in Corinth is that they met in people's houses. Early on, probably within the beginning part of the second century, churches began to own property. And the way that I know that is the Edict of Constantine in the early part of the 300s, said that the Roman government would replace the property that had been seized from churches. They didn't replace the property that had been seized from individuals during persecution. But the Edict of Constantine does say, we will replace that property that we seized that was owned by churches. So that tells me that prior to that time, churches had property. Now, we can talk about the way that they got that property. In many cases, it was bequeathed to churches when someone died. It may have been a part of their estate. And if somebody died with no children, or their children had already died or something like that, somebody might say, well, I have this property. If I don't give it to someone, then the state's going to take it. And I don't want that. So I'll just give it to the church. And that makes some sense. But when the church responded to the need in Jerusalem in 1 Corinthians 16, they weren't responding from a built-up surplus that they had. The people that worshiped in Corinth said, we're going to help the people in Jerusalem. So they began gathering funds. Now, they may have gathered funds for a year, and we know that that was a reasonable time frame from what the apostle has said. So they perhaps put together funds for a year so they could have them ready when Paul got there and they could send them. They weren't building up a surplus. So the need comes first, not building a financial surplus and then determining what we can do with the funds that we have available. Not very often have I seen elders sit down and say, this is a need that's been presented to us. And the only way that we can meet this need is for us to increase our contribution. We're spending money that's being contributed. It's meeting needs we've already identified. So now we have this other need. And we're going to go to the church and say, you know, in order to meet this need, we need to increase our sacrificial giving. $25 a month per family or something like that. But I think that's the way that the church in Corinth approached this matter. I don't know that the elders went to the individuals and said, you need to increase your contribution by $25. But I think that they first looked at need and then they determined how they could meet the need. Instead of saying, well, we've got $100 extra contribution coming in over and above operating expenses. So we can afford to support a preacher in a place where they don't have the financial wherewithal to support that man to preach the gospel. And the church here in Eugene helped to support me while I was preaching in Brookings back in 1975. Well, not 75, 70. That would have been 76, 77, 78. I don't know whether the church said we have the surplus funds and we can do this, or whether the church whether the church got together and said, we want to help Dean preach in Brookings. But I think that's the way that it would have happened in the first century. The church would have gotten together and said, we want to help Dean preach in Brookings, so we're going to make up our contribution. Now, we have done that on a more limited scale. We've been presented with needs that existed in the Philippines, for instance, and individuals have stepped right up and they put together funds and they sent the funds to the Philippines, typically through the hands of someone that was on the ground that they knew that they trusted. And so we have approached it that way. We didn't look at it and say, does the church have any excess funds that they can send to the Philippines? And we may have done that. It may have been a situation where we said, you know, we've been setting aside money to put the roof on the building, but this need is so great that we're going to divert it. We're going to divert at least part of it, and we're going to send that money to the Philippines. But need always came first. I went through this discussion with somebody else, and they said, well, if there's no need, then there is no reason to have a contribution on the first day of the week. And I said, yeah, that's pretty much what that means. And believe it or not, I have known of a church that had no need. When I was preaching in Anchorage, I got involved with the church in Adak, Alaska. That's a military base. And it was a total of three families that were on the military base. They could not even buy their own grape juice and unleavened bread because they were meeting on a military base, and the military chaplain had to take care of ordering that for them. They couldn't even pay for it. They had no need. Everybody that was in that church was they were all military. They were making the reasonable salary that goes with being in the military on Adak Island and all of that. So they had no need. One of those couples that was there in Adak said, "We know that there are financial needs that exist beyond our borders." And so that individual couple helped to support me while I was preaching in Brookings. But it was still a situation where you had the need first. You're not building a surplus. It's not that it's the first day of the week. You have to lay by in store. They wouldn't have been doing that if it hadn't been for that need in 1 Corinthians. So this need in 1 Corinthians 16, the reason that they were doing this was to meet the need that existed in Jerusalem at that time. Now, we have some continuous needs. So, yes, we need to continuously meet those needs. So, comments, questions?